From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in the year 2025 when scientists unveiled their newest advancement, a living dinosaur. We're no longer talking about science fiction here. Let me hand it over to Entrepreneur Magazine, which just published a piece titled, "Scientists Say They Can Recreate Living Dinosaurs Within the Next 5 Years." From the article, quote, "The renowned paleontologist who served as the inspiration for Jurassic Park protagonist Dr. Alan Grant is spearheading the genetic research that could engineer dinosaurs back into existence within the next 5 years," he says, end quote. Well, all of a sudden, we're right back to the dilemma posed by Jeff Goldblum's character in the original Jurassic Park film released 25 years ago. It's a question of whether we could, but also a question of whether we should. And this hour, we're focusing not just on that question, but on a range of questions about evolution, biology, why we love dinosaurs. Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom is, of course, the number one movie in America this week, because we can't get enough of the ideas of dinosaurs as being real again. So, a little science, a little fiction, and a little fun this hour. My guests include Larry Buckley. Dr. Buckley is Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Associate Professor in the College of Science at RIT, which hardly does justice to the work that he's done over the last 25 or 30 years on many of these subjects. Though, what was it, 25 years ago, you were asked basically these same questions, weren't you?
The same questions, Evan, yeah, and thanks for inviting me. Yeah, the same questions 25 years ago in 1993 as a graduate student.
So everything old is new again, sir.
Yes, yes.
Great to have you, Dr. Buckley. Also on the line with us is Amy McConville, floor supervisor in the Education Department at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. Amy, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well, and it's great to be with you this hour.
Yeah, Amy, is this just a case where, you know, we know our kids love dinosaurs, we become adults and we pretend that we're, you know, mature human beings, but when we get the chance to geek out on dinosaurs, we always will?
Well, I think every person who I've met coming into the Rochester Museum and Science Center has a favorite dinosaur that they've picked up probably as the first TV show that they watched or book that they read. And when they get to come back and experience it, that the moment the idea like sparks that you can have that actually in person or walking next to you, it truly sparks that passion and the excitement.
Well, I got to ask both of you just for starters here, because I think, what is it, the fifth Jurassic Park film, the second in the new version here, and they're all, you know, they're having fun with it. They're great visuals. But I want to ask you, and I'll start with Amy, whether the films have advanced or impeded the public's actual understanding of the science of dinosaurs. What do you think, Amy?
So the science of dinosaurs, I think what it's done in pop culture is that it's made people more curious about what happened with dinosaurs, and it's brought in broader questions about what are the characteristics of dinosaurs. For many years, we thought about it as specific facts. They had gone extinct at the end of the Mesozoic period, and now we have a chance to really think about it more detailed. You know, what are the specific parts of a body that may be recognized in other species?
Dr. Buckley, I'm looking at an article here that says velociraptors, we keep getting it wrong, that the films portray velociraptors as much larger than they were, that they didn't have smooth gray skin, that they were actually covered in feathers, bright plumage, almost like, you know, mildly scary peacocks. So that is not at all what the films do here. And it makes me wonder, what else are we getting wrong here? Do you think the films are a net positive or negative for scientific understanding?
Oh, they're definitely, Evan, they're definitely a net positive. There's no question about that. They're outstanding movies. They're definitely a net positive. And even from a scientific perspective, Jack Horner and those who've worked on the films, these great paleontologists, were right about a lot of the anatomy. Yes, it's true, Velociraptor wasn't as big as the one in the movie, but Udaraptor was, and it was even bigger. So there are raptors that are that big. That particular one isn't. But in general, yeah, a lot of the anatomy in the movies was great. Some of the behavioral stuff is probably very, very accurate. So I think a net positive on the movie.
Horner, in a Google talk, recently said that in 1993 they were making the film, 92, 93, and he said to Steven Spielberg, this is not what velociraptors were like. And he said, Steven Spielberg overruled him and said, these things need to be bigger and scarier. So, you know, but to your point, there were big and scary dinosaurs, and whether or not we get the exact title right in the film, okay. But 25 years ago, even in your own career, you were getting asked by journalists these same questions. Has anything changed in 25 years about what we are capable of doing with science to bring back dinosaurs in any form?
So there's some things that are very, very similar. In the early 90s, when DNA sequencing technology was really taking off, There was this wonder that could we simply recreate an entire organism as complex as a dinosaur or anything that's extinct from preserved DNA. So the search was on for preserved DNA. And you remember in those days, we thought we were getting preserved DNA. We thought we could get it out of amber preserved insects, particularly biting flies and mosquitoes. It turned out in the intervening years of the 90s that that DNA is gone. We aren't going to get that DNA out of those sources.
We're sure.
Yeah, we're sure of that now, for certain. Yeah, at least if there is any in there, Evan, I don't know if you remember any of this biology. Folks remember it from grade school and high school, but DNA is a repeat of four different chemicals, A's, T's, and G's. And you might get one or two of those still remaining in there, but you're not going to get a whole gene, or certainly not 25,000 genes, which it takes to make a dinosaur out of a fossil that's that old, right? So there might be some residual things in there, for instance, some residual colors and pigments that we've been able to pick up. But no, you're not going to get whole genes intact, not at all.
And so let me read from the article that I quoted right off the top here on what Horner is now saying in this piece titled, "Scientists Say They Can Recreate Living Dinosaurs Within the Next 5 Years." Quote, "While Dr. Jack Horner, who has consulted on all four Jurassic films, initially believed the key to recreating the prehistoric creatures lied in working with ancient DNA strands, further study about DNA degradation over time has since ruled out that possibility. Instead, a group of scientists at Harvard and Yale have turned their eyes to the modern-day chicken. Of course, birds are dinosaurs," Horner told People magazine, "so we just need to fix them so they look a little more like a dinosaur. In an attempt to reverse evolution, the team has already made significant strides in mutating chickens back to the very creatures from which they descended. If that wasn't enough genetic splicing and dicing, Harvard scientists attempted a similar feat recently by inserting the genes of a woolly mammoth into elephants in order to recreate the extinct beasts. If the four major differences between dinosaurs and birds are their tails, arms, hands, and mouths, Horner and team have already flipped certain genetic switches in chicken embryos to reverse engineer a bird's beak into a dinosaur-like snout," end quote. All right, so let's get both of our guests to kind of comment on this. That's not the same as we've got this DNA, it's preserved, it will be an exact replica. This sounds more like a chicken slash dinosaur, if they were able to do it, or an elephant slash mammoth, not quite a woolly mammoth. But Dr. Buckley, do you think this is overstating the case and possibility? What's the scientific understanding of what we're looking at here?
So it's overstating the possibility to say that we can reverse engineer a chicken into a dinosaur. I think folks have to keep in mind that dinosaurs and chickens had a common ancestor that predated them by 100 million years or more, actually. And so all you're going to get by reverse engineering some genes that cause chicken embryos to grow tooth buds and then lose them later, is a real good insight into how chickens develop. But you're not making a dinosaur by doing that. So it's important to understand that these organisms are 25, 30,000 different genes all interacting simultaneously during the development of the organism. And to recreate those interactions to make what existed in dinosaurs, non-avian dinosaurs, as we call the big exciting ones, right, is combinatorially, in mathematics terms, virtually impossible, right? You can learn a lot about how a chicken develops from studying the genes that caused the chicken's ancestors' hands to evolve into wings. The bones are still in there. The genes are still in there. But that's not the same as creating a whole different species. That's a very different thing. Yeah.
Amy, I hear this stuff, and I think it's way beyond my pay grade, but I wonder if you think that that we should be pursuing this. Just scientifically, as someone who works in the field that you do, and you see people with all of this fascination about evolution and what has happened over time, does this feel a little out of bounds, or how does it feel to you?
Well, I think it sparks that curiosity, and we don't want to discourage any scientific inquiry, but the idea of it happening by 2025, I think we know that there's different DNA and genetic works in progress for bringing back the passenger pigeon and things like that, which went extinct, you know, a little over 100 years ago. So we want to be very careful in what we're trying to accomplish with the amazing strides that DNA sequencing and technology has made. We also need to think about taking it from that information and not overextending it.
So let's talk about some of the ethics here. And let's go ahead and reference, I wasn't a huge fan of the Jurassic Park films when they first came out. I did think that Jeff Goldblum clip is really good. I do. And so I want to listen to it. This is from the original film in which Goldblum plays Dr. Ian Malcolm. And he is, of course, debating whether or really confronting the Alan Grants of the world for what are you doing and why here? Let's listen to that clip.
Don't you see the danger, John, inherent in what you're doing here? Genetic power is the most awesome force the planet's ever seen, but you wield it like a kid that's found his dad's gun.
It's hardly appropriate to start hurling generalizations.
If I may, I'll tell you the problem with the scientific power that you're using here. It didn't require any discipline to attain it. You know, you read what others had done, and you took the next step. You didn't earn the knowledge for yourselves, so you don't take any responsibility for it. You stood on the shoulders of geniuses to accomplish something as fast as you could, and before you even knew what you had, you patented it and packaged it and slapped it on a plastic lunchbox, and now you're selling it. You want to sell it. Well,
I don't think you're giving us our due credit. Our scientists have done things which nobody's ever done before.
Yeah, but your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should.
All right, first of all, Jeff Goldblum rules. I love that scene. But I think it's really good. I think the question's important. And, you know, so let's tackle this here. Larry, when it comes to whether or not they can, is there anything useful if science does create some sort of a route to recreating a lost species, whether it's a dinosaur, or as Amy, I think, really aptly points out, there's many other more recently extinct species that maybe we wish we could have prevented their extinction. Is this a good idea? Is there a public utility to doing this?
So there is, Evan. I mean, there's a tremendous public utility to using the technology that Jack Horner and others refer to, the CRISPR technology, for exchanging genes from previous organisms into genomes of existing species and seeing what that changes in the existing species, like the chicken example he uses where they recreate or try to recreate a more primitive version of their wing. There's tremendous value in that because of what it teaches us about gene expression and how gene expression affects the development of an organism, and particularly how we can use that knowledge to help affect therapies on disease states, for instance, crop pesticide resistance, drought resistance. It can be used, that technology and that knowledge can be used across the gamut, from not just with vertebrate animals like dinosaurs, but with all living organisms. So it's extremely valuable work. The work is also valuable from a philosophical perspective to try and convince people of the deep, deep age of the planet and respect for that deep, deep age of the planet and the living organisms on it. So from a conservation perspective, it's extremely important work. I don't think it's particularly important, and I don't think the work that I've read is being used to recreate dinosaurs. It's not. I know that makes a great clip, but it isn't really being done for that purpose. The developmental biologists that are doing it for these other reasons, and they're very, very valuable reasons.
Okay, and so this is where I think I'm going to take a little bit of a quibble with the new movie. In the new movie, and we've got a clip from that in just a moment here, I think it's Bryce Dallas Howard with Chris Pratt, and Bryce Dallas Howard's character is talking about the sense of wonder in the film that she felt when she saw a living dinosaur. But I think I want to listen to this clip, and I think I wonder if Amy McConville is going to have a different view, because I still feel that same sense of wonder when I see a recreated skeleton. You know, I don't need to see a living dinosaur to say, wow, these things were real. But let's listen. This is from the new film with Bryce Dallas Howard and Chris Pratt.
Do you remember the first time you saw a dinosaur? First time you see them, it's like a miracle. You read about them in books, you see the bones in museums, but you don't really believe it. They're like myths. And then you see the first one alive.
This is not your fault.
But it is.
No. This one's on me. I showed him the way.
All right, so I don't know, Amy. I feel like when I walk into RMSC or if I go to New York City, I go to museums all over the world, I still feel a massive sense of awe and wonder when I just see a bone. I don't need to see a real creature. And maybe I'm just not, maybe I'm overly imaginative. Maybe the average person doesn't. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, when we have visitors come into the museum, there's a Albertosaurus cast of the fossil that's right by the East Avenue entrance. And it captivates the audience because, first of all, they've walked through all of the gallery of Expedition Earth. They're passing by mastodons and caribous and muskox as they, like, weave their way all the way back in time, where they only get about 67 million years back, but they get to see that Albertosaurus. And they first look at it and they say, oh, it's a T-Rex. And you've got to bring them back and take a moment and say, well, what makes you think it's that way? And that inquiry, just the excitement, you want them to look at the pieces, see the size of the legs, looking at the shapes of the fossilized bones. Some of the kids are petrified at first. So then you have to point out the fact that their arms are really no bigger than, you know, if I'm talking to a four-year-old visitor, the arms may not be any longer than theirs. And you say, well, what do you notice as really large characteristics? And the first things they'll point out are the teeth, the nose, all of that bone structure in the skull. And it's really, for me, it's that wonder and anticipation that we really need to focus back in on looking at fossils. Maybe we can't find those, or we know we can't find those right now in the Rochester area for dinosaurs, but there are millions of fossils that date back earlier during the glacial period that, you know, getting people out exploring shoreline safely, you can kind of look into that experience and have those, like, tangible, exciting pieces to learn from without necessarily going into the whole, how do I recreate it? Because we need more research still. We need that time to develop before we scientifically take steps further.
I remember walking through RMSC with my son when he was 5, and I said, look, a mastodon. And he said, it's a mammoth. And he went in to explain to me what the difference was that he had learned in school and on a trip to RMSC and how amazing he thought it was. I mean, he had this great sense of wonder and corrected his dad on some of the details. So I thought that was really cool. And I didn't need to feel it in the fur, in the flesh, to feel that wonder. So now let me turn back to our guest in studio, Dr. Larry Buckley, who is Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Associate Professor in the College of Science at RIT. And Dr. Buckley has developed courses in evolutionary biology. Your work, among many other things, have been directed toward increasing our understanding of biological evolution in the Central Americas, the Caribbean region. And here's an email from a listener who says, Evan, any genetic tampering is raising science to a religion, playing... Oh, boy, I just related the... Oh, here it is. Let me read it again. Any genetic tampering is raising science to a religion, playing God, which I have an issue with. Let objectivity stay as the core of science. Well, Dr. Buckley, that I understand. But I think I want to ask a bigger question as I think about the advance of human beings on this planet. There's more 7-point-something billion humans now. A lot. I mean, we didn't cross 1 billion until, what, recently, like 100, 150 years ago, whatever it was. So the increase in our species has led directly or indirectly to the loss of some other species. So forget the fact that we wanted to create dinosaurs for a theme park that would be fun. When we talk about the utility, is there an ethical argument toward trying to do whatever we can to recreate even recently lost species because of trying to kind of counterbalance the impact of humans in this world?
So it's a good question, Evan, and I hear that a lot from folks. So the latest thing you see about every 6 months on the internet that someone has said we're going to have a woolly mammoth, right? We're going to find DNA in a woolly mammoth, and we're going to put a woolly mammoth DNA into the egg of an Asian elephant, which is their closest relative, and we're going to get a woolly mammoth out of it. And the technical hurdles aside, because there isn't intact DNA in a frozen woolly mammoth, the idea of whether or not we should is not an easy question to answer, because the environment that animal existed in is no longer there. Because that's part of the reason those animals went extinct. Now, there's a debate about megafauna like woolly rhinos and woolly mammoths and whether humans did that and killed them off or whether environmental change during the cycles in the last 3 million years of warming and cooling did that. But those environments that they lived in are very, very different now than they were when those animals were alive. So what would we be doing? Would we be recreating it to put it in a zoo, in an artificial environment? Because the environment it existed in isn't there anymore. And the same would be true of a dinosaur, even if we could do it, right? So there is a good ethical question.
What about more recent species? I mean, I understand the woolly mammoth thing. From everything I understand in reading the scientists, and there's a woman who wrote a book called How to Clone a Mammoth, and essentially the conclusion is the best we could do is to create what looks like an elephant who dresses up as a woolly mammoth for Halloween. I mean, we're not getting an actual woolly mammoth.
Right.
But that's not the same as asking about recently extinct that science tried to save. I mean, there's endangered species. I'm sure every day there's extinctions happening, certainly every year. If we could try to find a way to bring back recent species, is there a utility there that's very different than, say, a woolly mammoth?
So there are some utility. There is some utility there. I'll give you an example from Australia. There's one of the only pursuit carnivores in Australia was called a marsupial wolf. So everybody should Google marsupial wolf. And you'll see video of it from the early 19th century. They used to be on the mainland, then they were restricted to Tasmania on the island, and then eventually driven to extinction mostly through hunting. That changed the ecology. The loss of that carnivore in Australia changed the ecology of Australia and Tasmania. And so there's a case to be made from an ecological perspective that bringing something like that back would bring back a more complete ecosystem in those habitats. So there are examples where you could make an argument from an environmental perspective that you are simply restoring what, through accident and ignorance, was lost. But those aren't, you know, there's a few of those kinds of cases around, you know, where you could make that argument.
Interesting. Very different, though, of course, than what we're seeing on screen. And Hollywood loves the dinosaur movies. That's what we're talking about this hour. Our guest, you're hearing Dr. Buckley in studio with us, and Amy McConville is on the phone, floor supervisor in the education department at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. And as I said, Amy, my son's testament that you guys do a great job there. And we always have a lot of fun with that. We're going to get our only break of the hour. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a number of other themes related to this conversation today. Jurassic Parks, or it's Jurassic World, I guess, the new film Fallen Kingdom is the number one movie in America. If you've got questions or comments, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We'll keep the conversation on dinosaurs if you want. I also want to talk about new fossils. Dr. Buckley can tell us about what science is finding in recent years and what his work has helped us better understand about understanding biological evolution. So let's have that conversation when we come back right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, it's the opening hour in our series that we like to call The Summer of Food on Connections. For the next couple of months, we're going to have conversations about food trends, industry, and a lot more. And we're starting with a conversation inspired by the late Anthony Bourdain. Controversial opinions in the kitchen. What do some of the best local chefs say about trends and what they'd like to do if diners would only pay for it? We'll talk about it. All right, welcome back to Connections. Before I get to the next question on biological evolution and our human understanding of it, let me just ask Dr. Buckley to tell us a little bit more. When we read that some of your efforts have been directed toward increasing our understanding of biological evolution in places like Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean region, tell me about some of that work.
Oh, well, thanks. It's exciting work because those parts of North America, down onto the Mexican Plateau and then further south into Central America, were very differently affected in the last 3 million years by glaciers than we were. So 15,000 years ago, there was 5,000 feet of ice on top of us. But that wasn't the way it was in most of Mexico and Central America. And so the organisms that are there now have been there for 5 to 15 million years or more, whereas the things that are around here now came back 10,000 years ago. They were driven south and then came back in, or most of them did anyway. And so what we see when we look at organisms in those areas is we see a history, a trace of a very much deeper history than we see in some of the animals and plants that live in this region of North America.
So Rochester's region is like the snowbird region for evolutionary purposes.
Yeah. Okay. Everybody came back. And that's an exciting history to trace as well, in and of itself, because we now know how things got back here. We know some of them came up the Mississippi River Valley and the Ohio Valley. Other things came along the coast. So that's an exciting area of research as well. My area of research in the tropics studies deeper relationships among organisms there for a couple of reasons. The first is so that we can understand how climate change has affected the tropics, because as you know, as climate change continues to affect us, sea levels rise, and then as the Earth cools, sea levels drop, and that's happened many, many times over the last 3 million years for natural purposes, not influenced by human activity, but as it is now. And what we see is a dramatic effect on migration patterns and on distribution patterns of plants and animals during that time when those things occur, and we can track those changes using DNA. So DNA is a really exciting molecule for that purpose. But we can do the same thing with organisms in North America. It's just we have a very much shallower period of time to look at. So the things in, for instance, in Lake Ontario, the fish in Lake Ontario, are very closely related. The populations there of native fish, the sturgeon that we worked on and things, those are very, very closely related sturgeon. They all are, you know, probably within one or two generations related to each other. Whereas other things as you go further south are can be 5 to 10 million years since they've had a common ancestor.
So, such interesting stuff as we look at climate change and long-term trends. And I wonder if you feel any frustration when the climate conversation, there are some who will inevitably say, well, the climate's always changing. Well, it is always changing. That's true. We are contributing to a rapid change that we haven't seen before. And that's really what climate change is about. But what do you hope is the practical application of the kind of work that you've done to our understanding? What will it help us do as time goes on?
So I'm hoping the practical application of sequencing DNA from populations of organisms and their relatives is demonstrating people what I mentioned earlier, which was the deep, deep history of the planet. And that needs to be respected, because you can know a fact without respecting it. So we can know about the anatomy of dinosaurs, but we don't have that wonder that you talk about, or that respect. So I want people to respect the deep history of the planet and of the organisms on it, because as we top 7 and on our way to 8 billion people, we're running out of room for all the organisms that are here, and some of them are on the short end of that stick. And so I think a deeper appreciation for the history, the deep history of the organisms on the planet is absolutely necessary. So it isn't just an act of, you know, kind of scientific excitement to sequence DNA. It actually has very practical, it seems philosophical, but it really isn't. It's very, very practical to discover relationships among organisms, because that helps you understand how old they are and how long they've been around. And so I think there is a real strong argument to be made that basic research needs to continue, and we need to continue to sequence DNA and find out how birds became what they are now from what they were when T-Rex was alive, because there were birds flying around when T-Rex was around as well.
And this is a great reminder to us that when we talk about climate change, the planet does not really need saving. It's us that needs saving. There will be some species alive, one would presume, unless we become... What's this one that's almost our size? Jupiter, that's the hothouse? Unless we become Jupiter, there'll be some species that survive. We may not. It's kind of the issue. But it sounds like your work reminds us of that, these long scales of time.
Yeah. And do we want to be the only species that survive? I mean, do we want a planet where we have humans, chickens, cows, and plants that we eat and nothing else? And I think the argument can be made, the moral and ethical argument, that no, we don't want a planet like that. We want a planet that has some of those things for their aesthetic value, for the pure beauty of understanding how long they've been here and the amount of time it took for Mother Nature to bring us that garden. And we don't want to ruin that garden. And so there is the technical side of the garden, and we've got to keep it going. But there's also a strong argument to be made for the moral and ethical maintenance of that, being good stewards of that. A strong argument for that.
All right, so I've got a follow-up to that, which I'll ask both of our guests in a moment, but let me take a first phone call. This is Rick in Brighton. Go ahead, Rick.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to go back to something that was said a little earlier in the segment about kind of a technical question about restoring the woolly mammoth. And, you know, I think a comment was made about it would only just be an elephant dressed up to look like a woolly mammoth. I think you said that, Evan.
Yes.
And so I just wanted to kind of clarify from my understanding. Number one, the entire Wolframout genome has been sequenced, as I understand, back in 2015. So all the information, I believe, is there. And even if it wasn't, given the availability of samples from Siberia, probably you could get the entire sequence, although I think it's already available. And number two, it seems that, you know, given the incredible pace of some of these technologies like CRISPR technology and some future next gen, that it would be possible, you know, incredibly expensive and technically demanding, you could replace the entire genome, say, of an Asian elephant with a mammoth, and therefore de facto have a Wolframout, whether you want to do it or not. I think that actually for not ancient species, but relatively recent, in 10,000 years is recent, you could actually bring these things back. Is that not true?
Well, Rick, first of all, it's a good question, and thank you. And I want to just clarify, when I said that what we could potentially do based on what my own reading is create an elephant that looks like it went as a woolly mammoth for Halloween, I'm essentially quoting a paleontologist friend of mine from Wellesley who said that the short answer to the book is we could create something mammoth-like but not quite a mammoth. But Rick is asking, Dr. Buckley, if maybe that's wrong. I mean, maybe it's more expensive and a lot of effort, but
yeah. So I think clarity here, Rick, is a really good question, Rick, because I wish more people asked it, because let's take the example. Even if you had a living woolly mammoth population right now, and you could hybridize a living woolly mammoth with an Asian elephant, its closest, then you would get that thing that Evan was talking about, that kind of a hybrid. If you had the complete living organisms. And the reason I say that is when an egg develops and is fertilized into an adult, there's all kinds of other signals inside the egg that are necessary to make that woolly mammoth. It isn't just the genome of the woolly mammoth. It's all the epigenetic things that occur during development that also make that woolly mammoth. And all of that information is gone. We don't have it. We have a primary sequence of woolly mammoths and several other extinct things. But that's very, very different than having an intact egg or an intact sperm from a woolly mammoth that has all of that additional information, particularly the egg. And so, no, it isn't the case that we can just and pop those things back into existence just because we have the primary sequence. There's a lot more that goes into making any of us than just the primary DNA sequence that a next-gen sequencing system can sequence. And CRISPR puts in one gene at a time, people might get the idea that it's kind of like a Lego set, right? You can just keep putting them in until all 25,000 of them are in there. The problem is one base pair change can be the difference between, you know, a chimp and a human, or 10 base pair changes or 20 base pair changes out of 3 billion in that genome. So one little mistake and you don't have a woolly mammoth anymore, right, from that egg that you took from that Asian elephant. So I want to give people the perspective of the hurdle that they're talking about getting over here. It isn't just recreating the primary sequence that you're right, we do have, Rick. We have the primary sequence of several extinct things. It's reassembling that in the way it was when woolly mammoths were here, and then having the additional information in the eggs from the woolly mammoth that were there. And those hurdles are not insignificant. As a matter of fact, I think I can safely say that getting the primary sequence from bits and pieces of the genome in frozen ones is the easy part.
And so, Rick, I would just say the book that might shed a little bit more on this is called How to Clone a Mammoth, The Science of De-Extinction by Beth Shapiro. And it doesn't necessarily conclude anything different than what you just heard from Dr. Buckley. But you want to follow up at all, Rick?
Yeah, I've read the book, and I guess what the point you're making, which is a good one, is that what is being said here is that because of epigenetics, that not all the information will be there, and therefore won't exactly be like a mammoth. And I can understand that is certainly a critical thing. Although epigenetics, I think, we still don't understand epigenetics completely and where it comes from, but I think that's a point. I think that we could get close to one. Again, I think the most important question is, should we?
Do you think we should?
I think it's a matter of control and economics. You know, if there's money available to do it, and if it can be not deleterious, why not? Okay, under certain circumstances, I don't see any reason why you shouldn't do this. I think if there are more important things to do with your money, with your time, and you can't, you know, overcome certain issues you can't predict, like, you know, the impact on the environment, where you release them, et cetera, et cetera, then I think you need to take a pause and at the very least go slow.
Very interesting stuff. Rick, thank you. Thanks for the phone call. And there's a listener who's read the book, How to Clone a Mammoth. So really, really interesting stuff here. If you're just joining us, by the way, why are we talking about cloning mammoths on Connections today? It starts because the number one movie in America is Jurassic World. And it's all about a conversation about our fascination with bringing back lost species, our fascination with dinosaurs, what science does and does not say is possible. So let me ask both of our guests, and I'll start in studio and then we'll ask both of you this. Dr. Buckley, how good is the American public's understanding of evolution to begin with?
So the American Association for Advancement of Science about 10 years ago did a study of 50 countries in the world. And it asked some questions about that, Evan, and it isn't good news for the United States. We were second from last.
Out of how many?
50.
49th out of 50.
Right ahead of Turkey. And so there isn't a good understanding of evolutionary biology and evolution in general. And I think this is why it's so important, your show today, Evan, because that message that I think people really need to understand the age and the diversity of the Earth as a result of that age and have respect for that and have knowledge of that. And no, the United States isn't in good shape there. In certain school districts, it's great. In certain populations of folks who are educated about modern biology, it's good, right? But as on the whole, as a country, we got a lot of work to do.
Amy, how do you feel about that?
Well, we recently had a traveling exhibit, Unlocking Life's Code, the genome exhibit here, and we created hands-on demonstrations to do. One of those, which was breaking down wheat germ and creating DNA necklaces that people could take home with them. And now by doing that, we had prepped the wheat germ with meat tenderizer, soap, hot water, and set it aside. And then within a Eppendorf test tube, we drop a little bit of that in with some of the rubbing alcohol, and you could watch it break down. Now, for the general audiences that were coming in, we had ages from all the way from 3 years old to adults who were saying, what exactly am I looking for? So the concept of DNA itself is so tricky to figure out for the general public that it's a really broad area that we can definitely take more time and help the audiences learn more. But we have to spark that curiosity and, you know, make sure that there isn't a fear of not knowing. Which I think can happen sometimes when people are unsure. We have to be ready to ask questions and be comfortable to say we need more research in this.
And you've got an event 2 weeks from tomorrow, Editing Our Evolution, Rewriting the Human Genome, and a chance for, I think, the public to continue its education in this. What do you hope comes out of that?
I believe the goal that's coming out of that is to really make sure that the local community has an opportunity to ask those questions in a formal setting with the research backing it up behind that, as well as not being afraid to simply say, I want to learn more. So that's going to be an exciting evening.
Friday, July 20th, and doors open at 5:45 for the Editing Our Evolution, Rewriting the Human Genome, rmsc.org, if you want to learn more about that event coming up here. So, you know, Dr. Buckley, when you say that human beings ranked 49th out of 50th when it comes to countries and their understanding of evolution, and one of the things you've continued to key on throughout this hour is how we could probably do better to understand timescales and permanence and just, I don't think we think very long term. And I think that it's natural not to, because when we think long term, if you ask the average person about their long-term life planning, they think 10 years, 20, maybe 30 years, or they think about their kids' generation. Long-term, 15,000 years ago, you said we were under 5,000 feet of ice. That is a blink of an eye on cosmic scales here. So what is it about education you think that could change our ability to kind of grasp timescales more?
I really want to echo Amy and the Rochester Museum's mission, along with all of our educational institutions like RIT, and the U of R and all of the colleges, universities, K through 12 institutions. It's so important to get that message out, to educate kids well about both the diversity of life, and not just how many species are out there, but how they got here. It's really important to do that. And that's why museums and academic institutions are partners in that effort. And museums are so vitally important. The beginning of my career was at the National Museum in Washington, D.C. And And the mission of these places is vitally important to helping people understand. And so we'll do it one person at a time. We'll keep educating folks. And museums are so important, Evan, because once you're done with school, you tend, in some sense, to never want to look at a biology book again. So museums are really important community assets, the places where people can go and continue that education.
If we don't do better with this, are we in trouble with climate change?
Well, it's part of the reason we're already in trouble with it, because we don't do well with it. I understand the timescale problem. It's hard. It's hard to conceive even 1 million years, and T-Rex was 65 of those ago. So I think efforts made at helping folks understand deep time, just like physicists are helping folks understand deep space, and we're doing that better and better with new telescopes every year. We as biologists need to help people understand deep time and how to think about it in ways that don't warp our current sense of the past the way some folks have a warped sense of that now.
Yeah, Amy, when people go to the museum, I, as I recall from various visits in recent years, there's occasionally exhibits that give you a sense, just in visual terms, on how long ago certain things happened. This bone is from such and such period, and this is this long in the scale of time. And I always thought the most effective way for me as a visual person is to see it as, you know, we are at 11:59 or 11:59 p.m. on the time clock out of a 24-hour day if the Earth had happened in just 24 hours. I mean, so much has happened. I think we're at 11:59 and 50 seconds or something. I mean, it's just in terms of human civilized presence on this planet, it's just nothing. And do you think that that visual representation is going to be helpful going forward? I mean, because we're so bad at understanding timescales and just what deep time means, what 15,000 years means versus a million versus a billion years, Amy?
I think that in that case, a timeline is a great way to kind of give the outline for exhibits. It exemplifies things. It puts it in a clear process. What happens the best for our visitors is really when they get a chance to get hands-on. It's not about someone lecturing or telling you to feel this way about it. It's when you get to touch it. It's when you get to ask those questions. So, for example, if we take it back to the idea that we have a mass extinction wall, which is in Expedition Earth, and it goes back, you know, 540 million years ago, and it goes all the way up to the modern period in terms of, ooh, we haven't had a mass extinction. But then right in front of it, you have an opportunity to take a moment and say, well, 10,000 years ago, this is a recreation of what a mastodon leg bone was like. You can actually feel that and say, where was 10,000 years ago? So when we put that juxtaposition there, I think it works very well. Time is tricky for, as we've been saying, it's hard for people to grasp. So the second you take it, you know, away from what happened yesterday, what happened earlier this morning, just to that whole scale, and even if you take it to what happened 100 years ago, people just are unsure because the details get so confusing. So that it is nice when you have a timeline scale, but we need to have an interest and a passion to want to dive in and take an understanding for a greater period.
Let me read an email from a listener named Keith, and then we'll close the hour with a little talk about fossils and filling in parts of the record as we do. But Keith writes to us and says, Evan, great discussion, but unfortunately, I'm afraid that we are doomed. That's because you can talk about time all you want. No one is making policy based on anything but the next 4 years. And as long as that continues, we are not going to solve any long-term problems. Keep up the great work. From Keith. Well, that's pretty pessimistic, but Dr. Buckley, I mean, I understand why Keith feels that way. Yeah. I mean, we can talk about understanding it. You can talk about education. RMSC can talk about all the work they're doing in helping people year-round with this. But if policymakers think long-term is 4 years and about political preservation of power, I see why Keith is pessimistic.
Yeah, it's true. It's some policymakers think short-term. Others are influenced by longer-term issues. So no, we're not doomed. We're not at all doomed. I want to put in a plug here for how great the technology that we've had in the last 30 years has helped us. For instance, when we teach kids now about population genetics, which is evolution, we can do that in an afternoon now with a computer in a way that we never could when I was in college, we took beans out of a jar, red and blue ones, and put them together, and that made heterozygotes and homozygotes. And you would count, you would be lucky in a two-hour lab to get 10 generations counted. Now on a computer, we can simulate 10,000 generations in 60 seconds. And so technology has helped the new generation. My kids have an amazingly more sophisticated understanding of deep time and deep space than I had when I was in school at their age. So no, I'm actually the opposite. I'm actually very hopeful that education has helped, technology has helped, and it can continue to help.
But it's got to bleed into the policy sphere.
Yeah, you're right. And that means we need good people in politics.
You notice the silence? Amy, do you want to add to that?
I think the important thing to edge on what Dr. Buckley was saying is that we really want to make sure that the points that we're bringing across, you know, our technology, those details are at our fingertips right now. If you go out to Lake Ontario, and we know that the lake sturgeon just a few years ago were really reintroduced because they were in such a decline in population. So if you go out and you happen to catch those things, take a picture with it. Share those experiences. Talk about what the shorelines look like. That information and those, that time that you spend not just touching the screen and finding the data, but figuring out how it relates to your life is what's going to make those changes moving forward. And that's how I'd relate it to politics, as soon as we can, you know, figure out in that sense how we want to move forward as a group.
All right. Well, before the hour is up, then, let me just ask Dr. Buckley to tell us a little bit about thoughts on, you know, we kind of riffed on the fact that earlier this hour that 25 years ago, here you were getting asked the same questions when the first Jurassic Park movie came out. And there's something fun about that. Not a whole lot has changed in the science of dinosaurs in 25 years. We're still not going to be making fresh T-Rexes anytime soon, probably ever. But when it comes to understanding the fossil record, what are you seeing? What's interesting to you?
Well, in the past 5, 10, 15, even 20, 25 years, amazing discoveries in the fossil record out of all the fossil beds, including some exciting things in China where we're routinely finding feathered dinosaurs now. So we're finding, these are small dinosaurs, these aren't T-Rex-sized dinosaurs, but smaller versions related to T-Rex that are fully feathered, you know, and or have feathers down the midline of the back or feathers on the tail. So some of those are well preserved enough that some of the pigments are even in, or the residual compounds from the breakdown of those pigments are still there, so we can make decent guesses at coloration. So those are exciting things. Really exciting, Evan, for me, are some of the soft tissue fossils that have been discovered. There have been some skin discoveries of dinosaur skin, and for me, that really brings a dinosaur alive, because that isn't a remade or a remanufactured dinosaur. That's the actual fossilized skin of that animal. So I encourage your listeners to go and Google dinosaur skin, and you're going to see what their skin really looked like. And it's in stone, yeah, but that is what it looked like. There was a fully preserved mummified version of an ankylosaur, which is a spiky club-tailed dinosaur out of Canada, and the entire front end of the dinosaur was preserved. It looks just like it looked when it was alive. So there have been some really, really exciting things that speak to that wonder that you and I have when we think about dinosaurs. No, this isn't a made-up thing. This is really what the animal looked like when it was alive. And those things are there now. We don't need DNA technology to rediscover that. It's available right now. Those discoveries have been made. And by the way, they'll continue to be made.
When it comes to the work that's being done, commercial diggers are sometimes just kind of trying to get down, grab what they can get, and it's sort of a monetized, it feels a little crass to an observer like me. How do you view that?
Well, we want to be really careful. And I'm glad you brought this up, because we want to be really careful with public lands, particularly out west. Amy's right. Those rocks from the Cretaceous are gone in Rochester. They're not here anymore. They're long gone. But out west and into Canada, they're still there. Those deposits are still there. Where Jack Horner and all those great paleontologists work, those deposits are still there. And so public land policy is really important, because some important fossil discoveries are still there to be had. And if public policy on public lands is allowed to pretty much have a Wild West policy where anybody can do anything they want, then yeah, we could lose important information. It isn't just important to find fossils, Evan. It's important to extract them correctly and to have exact locations of where they come from. And some of that information is lost when it's done privately for profit.
Hmm. Last thoughts from Amy. When a movie like Jurassic Park is in theaters, you know, both of our guests said that despite some of the schlocky science, it's a net positive for scientific understanding. And it certainly sparks interest. I mean, do you see more questions, more kids, more adults showing up at RMSC? Do you try to take advantage of that, Amy?
I mean, we'll definitely take advantage of that. I know one of the facts that I've brought into conversation was the idea of, it came up as a question from a visitor, if dinosaurs could stick out their tongues or not, and specifically the T-Rex, because someone had read about it. So I did a little bit more research with that, and it, because of some of the soft tissue fossils that had been found, it's likely not believed. So, you know, it's fun to share those facts, too, and to have that chance to say, I don't know, let's go check it out. Let's see if I can find more research. I mean, I think on a hot day like this, it is kind of fun to think about the idea that we look in fear of the dinosaurs, and at the same time, they couldn't have enjoyed an ice cream cone or a popsicle.
Amy McConville from the Rochester Museum and Science Center. See you there. Thanks for sharing the hour with us this hour,
Thank
Amy.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Larry Buckley, the associate professor in the College of Science at RIT. Thanks for all of the education and expertise this hour. A lot of fun. And we'll do it again in 25 years with the next round of Jurassic Park.
Great. Looking forward to it. Thanks, Evan.
Short break. More connections coming up.